Hello everyone, I'm Harry Bucknell. Thank you for downloading this podcast from ABF, the Soldiers' Charity. As the great Kenneth Alford's Voice of the Guns fades away, so I welcome you to this special first anniversary edition of General Talk, the monthly podcast hosted by ABF, the Soldiers' Charity, which in its first year has interviewed female Welsh Guardsmen, former ABF President General Sir Mike Jackson, and Army Sergeant Major Gavin Payton, to name a few. To mark our first year, we welcome to the programme the Chief of the General Staff, General Sir Mark Carleton-Smith, who talks frankly about the Army today, and in so doing reminds us that the British soldier is better informed, trained and equipped for the wide range of challenges our military faces in the 21st century than ever before. We begin with a look back on lockdown. I hope you enjoy the programme.
I'm bound to ask what the challenges have been in handling the pandemic, given that all important aspect of leadership, human contact, has been so restricted.
Well, it's been a fascinating exercise for an organisation that is, by its very purpose and nature, designed to operate in a crisis. And that's been one of our most distinct advantages. And I think wider government has recognised that our people's ability to distill a complicated problem down to its essentials and then create a coherent and intelligible plan, and then frankly to execute that plan, notwithstanding the difficult circumstances with respect to the pandemic, has seen the Army, in some respects, at its very best. The institution itself, of course, is predominantly a demographic who themselves never regarded themselves as at any particular risk. Young, fit, healthy, living predominantly an outdoor life. And so we've managed to sustain our operational requirements almost seamlessly without missing a step. And where we have had to take account of COVID protocols, such as our headquarters, we've discovered very quickly that remote, rusticated, federated command and control, decentralisation and mission command, which are all the attributes that create success on the battlefield, have been absolutely fundamental in terms of keeping the show on the road during the pandemic. So, in many respects, it's not been the challenge that it might have been, or certainly has been for all sorts of other institutions and organisations. And we've worked hard at keeping the net all informed. So I have done a series of calls on every conceivable social media platform, but I found myself speaking on occasion to upwards of 15,000 people. I mean, no CGS has spoken directly to so many across all ranks. And that's, of course, a fantastic opportunity and is the sort of initiative that one will want to continue with and we won't go back to. I also think that one of the lessons from the pandemic is, when left to their own devices, our young people are incredibly creative, adaptable and innovative. And section commanders and platoon commanders have got on doing with what they needed to do, albeit remotely and through digital and social media. So these things can be done. People are going to enjoy coming back to the close proximity of human contact as soon as they, realistically and sensibly, hygienically can.
Life will never be the same again is a great cry, but do you see things changing for the Army in the long run as a direct result of COVID?
Well, I think there will be a change to some work patterns. Many of our civil servants, for instance, have enjoyed the choice around being able to either work from home or in the office. I think others, at various junctures in their lives, may elect to do more from home, necessarily. The old adage of presenteeism and people having to be in the office for as long as their boss is in the office, I think has eroded very rapidly as a result of this experience. I think probably institutionally our contribution to national resilience in the round is something that will endure. There must be something for our reservists in all of this, and I'm almost certain that we will find roles and responsibilities for our reserve community that weds them much more substantially to being the first responders nationally around the country. And if the regular army is going to get smaller, which it will, and we want that regular army to be more active, more often, and more deployable overseas, then we don't want to tie them to fixed commitments in the United Kingdom. And that responsibility needs to get picked up by the reserve community. So yes, in short, there will be some enduring changes that will become embedded as a result of the pandemic. They were probably coming anyway, but they've been accelerated.
It's all about change at the moment. And on the subject of that, General Sir Nick Carter said the army could hold its head high following the recent withdrawal from Afghanistan after 20 years on operations out there. His comments, however, drew criticism and even question of the army's track record in theatre. Some even daubed the campaign as being irrelevant. You saw a great deal of active service in Afghanistan. Can the army hold its head high?
Well, I think Afghanistan was incredibly good for the British Army, and the army learnt a lot by way of the experience. And certainly today, senior majors and lieutenant colonels and everyone more senior to that have had formative professional experiences as a result of the campaign. And indeed, we have taken the lessons from Afghanistan and over the last 6 years very successfully destroyed the single largest terrorist caliphate in recent history across northern Syria and northern Iraq. And so the sense that somehow the Afghan experience and the campaign at the whole was a busted flush, was flawed from the start, I think is wrong. Tactically, the British Army learnt a lot and recognised that its principal output was to suppress a low-level rural insurgency, to create the time and space to build up the Afghan security forces. And I think the army did that very successfully. And we set the conditions for the wider maturing of Afghan civil society, the growth and maturing of Afghan ministries. They today, of course, are going to find themselves under very significant pressure without the Western military insurance that a residual footprint would have enabled. And I think the United Kingdom has been very clear that we would have argued strongly for the maintenance of that small military commitment. But today, of course, our focus is on executing an orderly military withdrawal and working out what residual support we can give to Afghan civil ministries without the advantage of a military footprint in the country. And of course, the withdrawal doesn't mean the end of the civil war. What it marks is the end of this direct phase of American and Western involvement. And what it may mean is that we move back to the status quo ante, which were a series of indirect phases. And I would be surprised if we didn't find solutions as to how we might continue to support the Afghan government militarily, but of course without having this fixed physical military footprint in the country itself.
Central to the story is, of course, the great British soldier. Today, training is comprehensive, sophisticated, and all-embracing, including an emphasis on mental health. Some say the modern army is too politically correct, too caring of its people, but duty of care over our soldiery is a function of leadership. Do you think the woke card has been overplayed, or is there room for further progress to be made yet?
Well, the army is a people organisation, and the longer I'm in it, the more I recognise that the army's reputation and integrity is reliant on how it treats its people. And I don't think that there's anything politically correct in seeking to treat one's people as decently as one can. And today's generation are different from those that we commanded as platoon commanders nearly 40 years ago. And they are much more demanding of their armies and their commanders. And in terms of getting, firstly, the very best from all our people, and recognising that today's complexity requires a combination of solutions and skills and life experiences, which speaks to harnessing as much of the diverse skill and talent of the United Kingdom as we can, I think speaks to an army that is as open-minded and as pragmatic about these issues as it sensibly can be, recognising that we are a disciplined, hierarchical, uniformed organisation.
What do you say to the old generals muttering into their telegraphs every morning?
Well, I say that they may feel fortunate to have served, as far as they're concerned, when they did, but today's generations have really one singular responsibility, and that's to make sure that today's army is as relevant and as effective as it can be.
I imagine the bar in standards has risen considerably now. Male and female soldiers can fight side by side throughout the army. It must have changed things a great deal, but it must have freshened things up. How do you feel about that?
Well, I think it's an important improvement. And some might have felt that it was awkward, that it really was a political initiative and we were simply being left to try and make the military best of it. But actually, in my experience, that's proven not to be the case. There's almost no distinction between our young men and women. And when I quizzed my own regiment's platoon commanders after a particularly tough tour in Helmand as to whether they were comfortable in the middle of a firefight in an irrigation ditch to be flanked on both sides by young women, I rather expected them to be not entirely certain. And the reality was exactly the opposite. They don't look at each other through a gender lens. They look at each other through a pure and simple metric. Are you up to the job? And can I trust and rely on you? And where the answer to that is yes, they really are very comfortable. And of course, our very best women are more than a match for our men.
Absolutely.
And the competition
Absolutely.
Is excellent.
Anyway, we are at peace now, which is a very good thing. But that wealth of experience we talked about in Afghanistan, gained in operations over recent decades, will all too quickly evaporate. In today's modern world of app, laptop, and follow me on Twitter, how do you keep the army focused on its war-fighting ability?
Well, the old trinity of the moral, physical, and conceptual components of fighting power are just as important today as they ever were. And indeed, given that technological progress, it's much easier to stimulate the intellectual muscle of today's army, because we are still one of the most operationally experienced armies in the alliance. In fact, that is part of our USP. And today's officers and non-commissioned officers are hungry for operational experience. They recognise the opportunities of tough, demanding, challenging and stimulating training, and the relevance that that has in terms of underpinning our deterrent posture. And they're also looking, you know, for the operational opportunities to add that sort of operational lustre to their own regimental histories that has sustained the army really over generations. And part of my responsibility is to make sure that the army is as relevant and as productive and as entrepreneurial as it can be at identifying these opportunities and making sure that we, you know, create the same platform for tomorrow's generation as the one that we've enjoyed today. So keeping the army focused on warfighting today isn't difficult given the advent of the return of great power competition.
You greeted the recent integrated review as an exciting challenge, but with the army's current strength of 84,000 and a continued downward spiral to 73,000, do you think the critical mass is sufficient to field a credible fighting force, given 30 years ago, when the army was over twice the size it is today, we were only just capable of sustaining an armour division in the full thrust of war for over 100 hours?
Well, I think the reduction in size of the regular force from 82,000 to 72,500 is less of an issue for the army than I was prepared to accept a smaller army so long as it was an army that was invested in. Because the crude metric of 82,000, but 82,000 that wasn't fielding modern transformed capabilities, that wasn't lethal, that couldn't deploy itself or sustain itself in the field, wasn't going to be a relevant and productive and capable institution. People wouldn't want to belong to an army like that. Whereas the sweet spot was something close to 72,500 to 74,000, and that meant that we were going to be able to ensure that we were going to upgrade all our principal warfighting capabilities, and that we were still going to retain, you know, the wider operational wrapping that was essential to field an integrated land capability in the future. And of course, the 72,500 regulars are reinforced by the near 30,000 reservists. So the all-up force is still just north of 100,000. And I think that's a sensible and credible metric.
Do you think government will stick to its promise to invest in this modern army?
Well, I think the army needs to continue to argue its case. I mean, there was a concern 3 or 4 years ago that land power was looking increasingly irrelevant given the challenges of space and cyber, and given the continuing debate over the relative wisdom and advantage of our interventions in Iraq and Afghanistan, the army was probably the service that was going to have the most difficult problem in the review. In the event, of course, I think we've emerged with a very significant reinforcement of investment in our equipment over the next 10 years.
After all, Navy's recent transformation initiative, First Sea Lord Admiral Sir Anthony Radokin cut the number of admirals in the senior service by 40%. There are roughly 6-7 generals serving in the army today, not far off one for every 1,000 men. Is the time due for rationalisation of our senior ranks?
Well, there's always a time to rationalise our senior officers. I mean, good luck to the First Sea Lord. Because what you need in all your organisations is sufficient width and breadth and capacity in your spine of your organisation in order to grow people of maturity, experience and professional wisdom. And as life becomes more specialist and as life becomes more complex, I think there's greater onus on that maturity and experience. And it can't be short-circuited. I also think that the army is still the largest service. As a result, we're the net single largest contributor to defence in its widest sense, across the Ministry of Defence, across the new strategic command. So yes, we need to make sure that we don't become top heavy. But I think simply imagining that the solution is decapitation and decimation of your general officer ranks wouldn't necessarily be the correct answer.
So we talk about being top heavy. Logic would seem to indicate that a small organisation should be easier to run and administer. In these days of manning and budget cuts, how do you justify the recent introduction of command sergeant majors when the army seems to survive without them for the last 350 years?
Well, they seem to have been a constructive initiative. And subordinate commanders have welcomed the advice, the transparency that it brings, and our junior ranks have observed that they enjoy that more direct dialogue with higher headquarters. And the reality of the cost is it's a mere footnote in the audit of an institution that's running costs of north of 10.6 billion a year. So it traditionally, of course, hadn't been part of the British Army's culture. But I think our experience of working alongside the Americans in Iraq and Afghanistan so closely over the last 20 years, we saw that there was room for this improvement and broadly speaking, it's been welcomed. But it is still maturing and bedding itself in.
Given their expense, lack of flexibility and role, do you think the comparatively few Challenger tanks we now have is worth the bother in the long run?
Yes, because I still think that there's a place on the modern battlefield for an upgraded main battle tank. And that's a view that is shared by all our principal NATO allies and actually by some of our key potential adversaries. I mean, it's striking that the Russians continue to upgrade and field a very substantial fleet of armour. But what is also true is that the range at which land engagements are now being fought is expanding exponentially. I mean, it's what I've occasionally called the Army's midway moment. You may recall that decisive engagement in the Pacific in the autumn of 42, when the opposing American and Japanese carrier battle groups never got within 100 miles of each other. Now, we're not quite at that juncture yet in the land domain, but we're getting close to it. The deep battle is now being fought over hundreds of kilometres, not tens. And what that means is that it may well become the decisive encounter and reduce a lot of the risk associated with the close battle. There will still be a close battle, which will be exceptionally lethal, because at the moment, surveillance and precision and lethality are in the ascendant. So if we're going to put people into the close battle, they still need to be very heavily protected, and they need to continue to be able to field the most sophisticated array of sensors and kinetic weapons. And in the future of the main battle tank, you see that writ large.
But the problem, surely, is one of, not the features of the main battle tank vehicle itself, but actually of quantity. That is the problem we face, because with 120 or 180 tanks, that's a morning's work for a set of Israeli drones, isn't it?
Well, it is if you're not going to fight close, deep and rear simultaneously. I mean, the Ukrainian experience, when they had their armoured brigades decimated principally by armed drones, was that they weren't fighting a deep battle or a counter-battery battle, and they're dispensed with ground-based air defence. They've taken the wrong set of lessons, necessarily, from the experience of warfare of the last 20 years. And it's bringing the full suite of divisional and core capability back to bear that is, you know, the central tenet of our transformation and modernization program. But you're right, we need to husband. If we're going to field fewer of them, we're going to have to need to husband them better and make sure that those that we retain are available much more regularly.
The irony, perhaps, is that since the end of the Cold War, President Putin's resurgent Russia is more of a menace to the West than ever before, and indeed is cited by the Ministry of Defence still as a main threat on land, sea, air, and now in cyber and space. The latter two being new territory, requiring new, radical, and unconventional thinking to counter them. How are you approaching this Wild West?
Well, you're right to observe that the threat is proliferating, and states such as Russia have effectively sought to weaponize those aspects of globalization that hitherto we thought might keep us safe, prosperous, and secure, such as the free movement of people, data, and ideas. And the answer is that we cannot cede any part of this spectrum to allow them to operate with impunity. And contemporary deterrence, therefore, requires us to be much more proactive and competitive across a suite of more asymmetric capabilities. And gone, I think, today is the single organizing principle of the army, which is to field a warfighting corps and a warfighting division for the one-off, once-in-a-generation requirement to fight a conventional and reasonably orthodox land campaign. Today, the organizing principle is to be much more active and much more lethal across this wider proliferation spectrum of threat, retaining the ability to escalate and re-aggregate to a conventional warfighting division and core capability when we have to. And that's going to put an emphasis on a wider suite of specialist capabilities, electronic warfare, cyber specialists, specialized infantry battalions designed to operate alongside a wider family of partners, including surrogates and proxies and potentially private military companies. On bits of the map fold, such as Africa, where traditionally we haven't had a natural footprint, but where that vacuum is incubating both terrorist threats and allowing free play to our adversaries who are using very systematically private military companies to fill those sorts of gaps.
You talk about the private military company, and of course, we go back to days of the East India Company. Is that sort of similar sort of expeditionary force type nation you're thinking of in that sense, in terms of territory building or presence feeling? How do you think, therefore, that if it's a British private military company, are you going to guarantee that you can work alongside them, or they're even operating on the right guidelines? Is it some sort of Does that require some sort of franchising or licensing on
it? Well, it requires all that, and at the outset it requires a much more innovative interpretation of our policy. Because I think part of the Army's ability to underwrite the political ambition around global Britain, which you might boil down and distill as Britain as a sort of scientific superpower, Britain as a world-leading integrator of both hard and soft power, and Britain as a global player. You want an army tomorrow that not just delivers its defence and security outputs, but also recognises that it's got a role to play with respect to opening up wider prosperity opportunities. And traditionally, the Navy and the Air Force have done that very successfully. Tomorrow, the army needs to recognise that it too contributes to opening up economic opportunities.
We've talked about Russia, Russia, Russia. What are your views on the elephant in the room, which is China, as Britain goes global?
Well, I think it would be a mistake to view China through a Cold War prism. But there are some substantial strategic trajectories associated with China. And that is that in the balance of this decade, it will become the single largest economy, eclipsing even the United States. The difference being that this is an economy controlled by a Communist Party, the world's most successful Communist Party. And if the indices are correct, by the middle of the century, its economy will be larger than potentially the United States and the EU combined. So it's going to be an economic powerhouse, and with that, it will come with the single largest and potentially most modernized set of armed forces. So it is a systemic competitor. And it's taken a very clear-eyed view that with data acting as the single most important part of the future global economy, it has a strategic vision for a new digital world. And they've even given it a name. China Standard 35. And so we are, whether we like it or not, embroiled in the first instance in a technological arms race against a competitor. But if we're involved in a competition, much better that we keep China as a competitor and not as a turn it into a potential conflict. I think that the single greatest danger today is potential strategic miscalculation. Because China does appear to take the view that the West is suffering a terminal structural decline and that there is a degree of historical inevitability surrounded with their rise. That is not necessarily true. There are all sorts of paradoxes and contradictions associated with modern China. I mean, I think it's telling that only 2 years ago they were having to spend over $200 billion on their own internal security. That's more than they were spending on their own modernization of their armed forces. But we need to be, clear-eyed about China. there's a degree of ambiguity, inevitably, and schizophrenia associated with our positions. We are economically hungry, and we will want to do business with China, so we need sufficient tolerance in our relationship with China, whereby we can do business in those areas where we have common values. We need a sensible conversation around climate change, for instance. But we also need a relationship that has sufficient tolerance to absorb those areas where we disagree around our values and standards, around their application of techno-authoritarianism, human rights, and the like.
I get the feeling from our conversation that the army today is a much more flexible organisation than it was of yesteryear, much more open to ideas and so on, even entrepreneurial, as you suggest. It has an almost 18th century sort of exploratory feel about it, which is exciting. But looking forward, with Brexit largely behind us, and as HMS Queen Elizabeth and her carrier group steams Asia bound, the Prime Minister's vision is of a global Britain, which is the foremost naval power in Europe. Is it looking good for the Army's integration into that Prime Ministerial vision, or is there any room for ships in the dreams from number 10?
There's always room for an organisation that is relevant to tomorrow's challenges and problems. And that will be the litmus test for the Army as to whether it can continue this trajectory of modernisation, and that it therefore fields a suite of capabilities that look useful and relevant to the Prime Minister and the government of the time. But the application of the military instrument is going to rely on the successful integration of all the levers across the military domains, land, sea, air, space, and cyber. And so there is almost no military scenario to which the singular solution is a carrier strike group. The real trick is the application of combinations of military capability, of which land is one of the fundamental features. And of course, we enjoy a USP, and that is that you can sail by these problems and you can fly by these problems, but if you want to materially change the facts on the ground, you need to be able to commit to the ground, and that is what the British Army does extremely well. It may not look and feel like Iraq and Afghanistan in the late 20s and the 2030s, and that will be a good thing because we will have taken the right set of lessons. But the Army will continue to be the principal proponent of persistent global engagement across a suite of long-term traditional allies and probably a growing family of new partners and allies on parts of the map that look stimulating, rewarding, and challenging for the Army of tomorrow. And that's precisely the opportunity that the young men and women who will be tomorrow's Army are looking for.
Do you think the prospect of, well, there is the hope that perhaps foreign outposts will return again in the years to come?
You know, is this a global Britain whereby it's an opportunity for the Army to open up new frontiers in new countries and give young men and women fresh opportunities? The answer is indisputably yes.
So now, you've been Regimental Lieutenant Colonel of the Irish Guards for nearly 10 years. Tradition counts for a great deal in the Army, but it should never set the agenda when the agenda moves on, I would think, and i.e. tradition shouldn't dictate tradition. We've seen the success of the creation of the rifles. Do you think it is time the infantry move to 5 battalion regiments and, as with everything else, bite the emotional bullet, be done with sentiment, reform uniform and rationalise the number of cap badges too? An emotive subject.
Well, there's always a balance to be struck in life. And a small dose of nostalgia is part of the important chemistry of the fabric of our regimentally based army. And I wouldn't deny the success of the rebranding of the rifles. But in many respects, I think we can harness those best aspects of it whilst preserving the very distinct and unique qualities of our wider regimental family. Because the modern soldier still feels that it's important to belong, to have a sense of family, to enjoy that sense of regimental continuity and tradition, and that distinctiveness and style that comes with their own regimental peculiarities and idiosyncrasies. So I think balance in all these things is important. However, the critical litmus test is, does it act as a spur to our operational capability, or is it a handbrake on it? And at the moment, I think it still continues to act as a sensible spur, but we are going to redesign our divisions of infantry and broadly ensure that the full suite of infantry roles are replicated across all divisions of infantry, so that no matter your regiment or indeed your battalion, through the course of a career, you can elect to serve in any number of variety of roles. And I think that opportunity and that variety is precisely the mix that young soldiers today want and indeed need.
It's been nearly 40 years that you and I have known each other, certainly. And a long road and many wars from those carefree days of Chelsea Barracks in the 1980s. The Troubles, Gulf 1991, Bosnia, Kosovo, Iraq, Afghanistan, and now over 3 years as the Chief. Looking back, what for you has been the highlight of your exciting and illustrious career?
Well, I've been very fortunate to have commanded soldiers on a variety of operations, you know, almost at every rank. And the highlights for me were commanding my very first platoon on operations in South Armagh as a platoon commander in Cross Maglen. And one of my strongest memories of walking past the ops board to see my particular patch being placed out of bounds. And at that moment, I realised that if I wanted to come back and serve in Northern Ireland, it would be in a guise and a manner when I was inside the out of bounds area and not observing it from the outside. And I've rather took that lesson with me through the rest of my career. I wanted to be in the out of bounds area at the very forward edge, deploying in the very first echelon every time a new operation and campaign unfolded. And I've been extremely fortunate in managing to find myself at the right time and place. But the highlight really is commanding our extraordinary young men and women and being responsible for unleashing their fighting spirit. And that is what has sustained me throughout nearly four decades.
You are now, as I said, over 3 years as Chief of the General Staff. What will your legacy be? What will be your "I did that" moment?
Well, I hope it's not over yet. But really, I mean, when I look, I'm surrounded in this office by the portraits of my predecessors, all of whom were the architects of innovations and change during their tenures as the Chief. But really what endures is their ability to have set the tone, style and atmosphere for the organisation and to have found and released the creative energies and entrepreneurial spirit of the next generation of officer. And so at the heart of any legacy as the Chief are the people. And whether I've got the people right or wrong will be determined in the future. But my focus has been on finding and creating the opportunities for that next generation of people. Specifically in terms of the initiatives, I think I will look back with interest as to whether the initiatives around the creation of 6th Division, our subject matter experts for asymmetric and unconventional warfare, the Army Special Operations Brigade, the nucleus of which is this new creation, the Ranger Regiment, whether they've flown, or whether actually the next generation haven't just built on that and the whole journey moves on, as will I.
Well, General Sir Mark Carleton-Smith, Chief of the General Staff, it's been a great pleasure to interview you today. On behalf of us all at ABF, the Soldiers Charity, thank you for being my guest on this special first anniversary edition of General Talk.
Thank you very much indeed, Harry.
If you enjoyed listening to this podcast and would like to learn more about the work of the Soldiers Charity or take part in its many events, please visit soldierscharity.org. With editing by Michael Stiglianu, this podcast has been a Gamekeeper production for ABF, the Soldiers Charity.